Chapter 90. The Lampless Alleys. The bootmaker's eyes travelled from person to person. "This had better be good," he threatened, but his grip relaxed. Miss Bocking approaches Johnny Wallace with an offer to do what she thought he did for his own amusement. Mr. G took to patting an imaginary large dog. "Id est violate another woman. However," he tickled behind the imaginary dog's ears, "Wallace was not a rapist. He did not mind assisting others to perform the acts for a fee, but it seems that all but the vilest criminals, such as this forensic specimen behind Miss Bocking, have their scruples." He shooed the dog away. In fact, in some ways, Johnny was an exemplary figure. He did not smoke, and he did not drink. "Well, he did when I met him," the bootmaker remarked. "Like a camel. That's how I was able to get him drunk and take his place." "Barmaid's gin," my guardian told him. "Water?" the bootmaker spluttered. "So he was faking it?" "Do you know why Johnny Walrus was so keen to hand the job over?" Mr. G fluttered his long, curled lashes. "Suppose you tell me." "A wise supposition. You have heard, I take it, of Hargorp Hanratty." "Who hasn't?" The bootmaker screwed up his face. "Even the Chinaman pays him dues. Hanratty has dedicated a substantial amount of his life to bringing the wealthy and gullible into his establishments." Mr. G half crouched. Even his chair was fanciful now. "And he was having considerable success until a series of attacks on women frightened them off the area. And he was so infuriated by the bad publicity generated by the attack on Miss Hockaday that he withdrew his protection from Johnny Wallace. The trouble is, as we know, he could frighten Wallace off, but not only did the attacks not end, they increased in frequency and viciousness. When Albatoria Wright was found, Hanratty put a bounty on the capture of any man guilty of attacking women in his territory, and was determined to make an example of him. Unfortunately, Geraldine's brother Peter made too convincing an impression when he pretended to be a procurer, and paid for his act with his life." "But surely, once he had explained he was her brother," Pound began. He had edged a good foot or more further.
"I do not think they gave him much of a chance to talk," I said. "His tongue was cut out."
"Like Princess Philomena," the bootmaker chortled.
"You have a good knowledge of the classics," I remarked, and his face darkened.
"That prying tongue of yours could get you into trouble," he warned. "And you have quite a tongue too, Mr. Grice." "And it has a great deal more to tell you yet," Mr. G replied with no evident concern, "including a revelation which you might find distressing. Mr. Hanratty has vowed to crucify, and he means that quite literally, the murderer of those two fine, though reckless, ladies in the lampless alleyways of Limehouse."
"You can't blame me for that."
The bootmaker waved his knife like an angry schoolmaster with a rule.
"They tried to trap me. In fact, the second one..."
"Dulcie,"
I breathed, sickened at the memory.
"That damned vixen pulled a gun on me,"
he told us in wounded tones.
"And if her friend had not distracted her by begging for help, she could have done for me. But I saw my chance and took it. One chop with this knife and I had half of her hand off, and the gun with it."
He paused in memory of the event.
"She was a game one, though. Not a glimmer of fear as she tried to fight me off. Gave me a good old knee in the crotch, tore at my hair and cracked my skull on the wall. Made my head ring like a Sanctus bell. I would have liked a lot more time with her."
"You disgusting—"
"Don't march," Pound cautioned. "It's exactly what he wants. But he's no man when he can only frighten women and girls."
I wondered briefly if George knew the true significance of what he had just said, but realized that he could not have. The bootmaker's face blazed, but it was then that I saw his powers of self-control. In a moment his expression turned to a sneer.
"Still on first-name terms,"
he grinned.
"Which of you wants to watch the other die?"
It was then also that I saw George Pound's self-possession.
If I rush you now, he said calmly, you won't have time to aim for my head, and it will take at least 3 shots in my belly to bring me down before I get there. Think Mr. Gryce will stand calmly back while you fire them off?
Think Miss Middleton will? I added. Please don't, Lucy implored.
The bootmaker narrowed his eyes as he weighed us up.
Let us try it out, shall we?
He tried to outstare George, but Pound met his eyes coolly.
Only if I disable you and this pipsqueak first. I can promise you one thing, Inspector. Your lady friend will have a very messy end indeed. And as I have already hinted to my unusual ward, Sidney Gryce chatted blithely, jealousy may well be the root of the malice that ignited, then smouldered, in the ruins of Steep House.
How in the name of Hades did we get on to the subject of that infernal house again? The bootmaker expostulated.
Because that unworthy emotion, Sidney Gryce plucked floating petals from the air over his head so convincingly that I could almost see them myself, was not germinated, nor did it take root or flourish within the noble heart of Miss Frieda Tulsimer Wilde, for she loves her friend who, it transpires, hates and envies her.
Envy, Freddy? Lucy scorned. For what?
It was Miss Wilde whose parents were rich, whilst yours, though she did not know it, were facing penury. It was Miss Wilde who was clever and witty and turned all the boys' heads. Most pertinently, it was Miss Wilde who stole the heart of your beloved brother Eric.
Sidney Gryce watched his petals float away with an almost beatific expression.
That is a lie!
The chair rocked violently, and if Lucy Bocking could have broken her bonds, I would have feared for my guardian's safety.
Eric may have had a crush on Freddy, but I was the one he really loved.